Choral conductor Alan Denny explained in the Choral Journal that a symphony conductor was recently invited to speak to a group of elementary students at a charter school, and during his presentation, he posed a question to the young audience. What would happen if we stopped performing Mozart's music? A young girl raised her hand and replied, "Mozart would start to disappear." Choral conductors consistently strive to find artistic balance in the selection of repertoire. Standing upon the monumental shoulders of the past giants of choral expression, while remaining open to contemporary musical conception and innovation. It's as if choral conductors are driving an automobile. Conductors are always peering ahead while simultaneously looking in the rearview mirror, closely watching the direction of the future while showing deference to the past. Undoubtedly, one of the choral conductor's foremost responsibilities is to promote choral music so that it exists long after they themselves and their audiences are gone. One of the highest callings is to seek the pieces that will endure and sustain, not just the works, but the art. Choral conductors must ask themselves these pertinent questions. Will what I select and perform be strong enough to last longer than I do? Will my students and audiences remember this piece? Is it enough to sustain them? Yet even more pertinent questions need to be asked. What does the future hold for the choral art? What does its emerging landscape look like? To address these issues, 8 composers were asked to respond to a series of questions regarding the future of choral music. The answers we'll hear will shed light on the music on the next concert by the Merriwood Chamber Singers. Alan Denny reports that when the choral works written in the 21st century were considered by these composers, they asked them, which ones will endure? Stacy Garup suggests that Erich Eschenwalds is developing a great portfolio of choral music that possesses remarkable clarity, beautiful sonorities, a wide range of emotions, and a wide range of topics. All of this suggests that his music has staying power. This is, in fact, Stars by Erich Eschenwalds. When asked, what do you as a composer see as the biggest strength and the biggest weakness in the 21st century choral repertoire? Timothy Takacs replied, one of our biggest strengths is that we have access now to music from all genres. He continued, even with all this potential variety of inspiration, though, as an industry, we're still clamoring for more of the same. We're singing the same contemporary music from 20 years ago. Composers are still writing in the style of the best-selling music on the market, and publishers are still publishing it. Many composers are trying to push forward, but the industry is slow to react. A composer might be risky as they are composing a new piece, but that music has a very small chance of having a life on the concert stage beyond the premiere. Many ensembles tout their new music, new commission, hot composer, and yet it's so derivative. The message that is sent to emerging composers is that if they write in the style of music we've all heard before, you too can have your chance at being performed. Our biggest weakness is not having guts. More composers need to have the guts to write in their own voice and not cater to what's already being performed. These composers were also asked about the way they see choral composition changing in the next 20 years, and Z. Randall Stroop replies, in terms of compositional style and new frontiers, I believe choral composition in the Baltics, among others, continues to push boundaries and challenge the harmonic, timbre, and sonority possibilities for audiences. Again, Erich Eschenwalds from the Baltic region. And returning to the question of weaknesses in the 21st century choral repertoire, Andrea Ramsey believes it might be the sheer abundance of homophonic works, many of which are marked at slower tempi and occasionally with little rhythmic or melodic variety. Now, there's nothing wrong with slower homophonic works, and some can be strikingly enjoyable to perform as a singer, which is, I think, why we have so many of them. Some of my own works would fall into this category. However, in examining the 21st century choral catalog as a whole, perhaps too great a percentage of our works comprise slow, homophonic pieces. A dear friend of mine once asked in complete sincerity, "Do you think polyphony is dead?" A great conversation ensued, and I believe it will be interesting to see if, as in as much of any art's history, we have a reaction to what has come before. Will there soon be an era in which polyphony flourishes in response to our current homophonic trend? And later in this session, Eriks Eschenwald states that missing elements in current musical education are the teachings about contemporary polyphony and different compositional techniques like that. Rick Hoffenberg is a thoughtful choral conductor who continually reflects on all these matters, and his carefully crafted and creative concert programs reflect his desire to, as we heard at the start from Alan Denny, find artistic balance in the selection of repertoire. For the spring concert of the Marywood Chamber Singers, Dr. Hoffenberg includes music from the Baltics by Eriks Eschenwald, cited by the panel as being a strong and vital force as a composer. There will be a piece by Kevin Putz, who is not afraid to follow his own path, and that resonates with the concerns we heard from Timothy Takacs about composers lacking, in his words, guts. And in connection with his choice to open the program with pieces by Renaissance composer Orlando di Lasso, Dr. Hoffenberg expresses his concern that current choral composers aren't drawing on the august tradition of counterpoint and polyphony in the beauty that can result from those techniques. The very same lament offered by, as we just heard, composers Andrea Ramsey and Eriks Eschenwald. Dr. Rick Hoffenberg, Director of Choral Activities at Marywood University, stopped in at the WVIA Benko studio to talk about the considerations in putting together this upcoming concert pair.
I love combining music that people will know and music that people might not know. I love broadening people's horizons, both people in my ensembles and people in the audience. But I also recognize that people like to hear some things that are familiar, if not the pieces of music themselves, familiar composers or familiar styles of music. So I want to try to appeal a little bit to both sides of the coin.
You have different eras and countries in this performance.
Yes, and whenever I program a concert for our spring semester, I'm always aware of the fact that we're going to be taking this program on tour and performing for audience members I've never met who may or may not regularly attend choral concerts. And so I want to introduce them to what we do and show off the talents of our students, but also I want it to be very audience friendly. So we do have a little bit of everything in this program, from Renaissance to American music, music by European composers, different eras, 19th century up until pieces that have just been written, and also some vocal jazz, which has been fun for the students to work on.
Take us to Lasso and tell us what is compelling about Lasso's music today. It's not just something that should stay in part books.
Oh, I so agree. For one thing, music of that era is so fascinating in its use of counterpoint. A lot of contemporary music, some of which I really love, is essentially built on homophony, a series of chords, which might be very beautiful sonorities. But you go back to the Renaissance, and the way voices are woven together in independent textures of up to eight voices or more, sometimes far more, is just extraordinary. And sometimes I wish there were more counterpoint in music of today. You know, ever since the Renaissance, composers have looked back to and admired composers like Lasso and Palestrina and Byrd and Victoria. And there's a reason. I mean, in some ways, the High Renaissance was the height of musical composition. And I feel like studying that music and seeing how voices work together to form consonants and dissonance and suspension and expressive beauty is really a joy. It's a joy to work on, it's a joy to conduct and to sing. And I will add, Lasso, among the titans of the Renaissance, is certainly one of my very favorites because I feel like he's a risk taker. He wrote in a variety of languages. He was somebody who traveled all over Europe and really absorbed influences from everyone he met. And so his music is all that much more fascinating and sometimes unexpected. And that makes it even more fun. He combined this amazing skill with an open-mindedness to different possibilities. So we're going to be doing two psalm settings by Lasso in our chamber singers program, one for five voices, one in double chorus for eight voices. And I think they will really give the listeners a sense of what Lasso was capable of.
What about Lukaszewski then?
We're going to follow sort of laying the foundation of choral music with the two Lasso motets. We're going to follow with two Eastern European composers of today who are quite well known by people who attend choral concerts regularly, Lukaszewski and Eriks Esenwalds, from Poland and Latvia, respectively. And they are the most famous and successful composers of their generation from those countries. Lukaszewski is a composer who uses a style that he calls a renewed tonality. And I think that's a very apt phrase because his music is resolutely tonal, and yet he uses sometimes exotic sonorities in order to create really interesting effects. This particular piece that we're doing is called Daylight Declines. It sets a 16th century text, and the central idea of a sunset is portrayed so beautifully through his music, using different scales and a descending triplet motif that gradually he interprets as the sun going down. And at the end, everything just sort of collapses in a way that is so picturesque, and you can just see the sun setting in the final measures of the piece. He's a very colorful composer, very expressive, and you really get the sense when listening to his music of how much choral music is at the core of Poland's culture. And frankly, that's true of a lot of Eastern European countries.
Thank you.
So juxtapose the daylight declining with sleep that takes place after sunset.
That's right. And yet, despite that connection, Only in Sleep is a much sunnier piece. I did want that contrast. I don't want to depress the audience. It's a beautiful folk song in a way, and Essenwald sets it in a rather simple 8-part texture, but through the use of a variety of voicings and having the background to a soprano soloist sing, sometimes text, sometimes a neutral syllable, sometimes humming, he creates these beautiful background textures. And even though there are complexities in the piece, I think it's the kind of piece that the audience will listen to and feel like it's straightforward and simple, just a beautiful melody that they will walk away singing.
And on to England, there is sweet music, and don't we love pieces about music?
Yes, absolutely. And this is a piece that belies the idea that Elgar was a conservative. He's often put into the camp with composers such as Rachmaninoff, 20th century composers whose feet were steadfast in the era of 19th century Romanticism. And I think that's somewhat true. Their lives coincided with people like Schoenberg, who was moving in the direction of 12-tone music, and Stravinsky with primitivism and everything he was doing, and Bartok and the Impressionists, Debussy and Ravel. And Elgar didn't go in any of those maybe more, slightly more radical directions, but this piece, I think, is interesting because on the face of it, Elgar sets himself a limitation that seems like it wouldn't work. He sets the soprano and alto parts in the key of A flat major throughout the whole piece, and he sets the tenor and bass parts in G major throughout the whole piece. And if you've never heard that piece, that sounds like a headache. But he makes it work beautifully. Initially, he introduces them separately, so he weaves them through transitions. You start with the tenor and bass, and then using common tones between the G major and A flat major scale, he transitions to the sopranos and altos. And then he starts bringing them together in ways that find commonalities between those keys. And only at the end is there really a conflict between the two keys. He sets them apart back and forth, and ultimately at the very end, one key wins out. But it's a fascinating study. It's beautiful music on the face of it, but it's also an amazing demonstration of compositional skill that he could do that.
And what text did he choose to do that work?
Right. It's a text by Tennyson, There Is Sweet Music. that has been used in other pieces as well. And it's very picturesque. And of course, as you pointed out, it's wonderful to have music about music, which makes it, I think, doubly engaging.
And Fair is the Heaven, F-A-I-R-E, an earlier way of spelling. Is it an older text?
Yes. It's funny that you bring that up because the members of my choir, I think, were, I won't say struggling a little bit, but the first time we read through the text, there are a number of archaic spellings. And so I think they were a little bit confused by some of the spellings of common words. Far is spelled F-A-R-R-E and so forth. It's a text by Edmund Spenser called A Hymn of Heavenly Beauty, and it was first published in 1596, which is why some of the spellings in the text are not the same as contemporary words. But it's one of the most famous English part songs, I think, of any era. It's frequently performed. It is probably Harris's most famous work. So I think if people haven't heard the piece before, I'm excited to give them an opportunity to hear one of the great pieces of British choral music.
Well, now we have Sweet and we have Fair. We've just heard There Is Sweet Music and Fair is the Heaven. And we have another Harris, Christopher. So Wondrous, Sweet, and Fair. How is that?
Right. So this Harris, Christopher Harris, we've performed music by him before. I'm a fan of his music, no relation to William Henry Harris, the British composer. Christopher Harris is an American composer born in 1985. He amalgamates traditional choral textures with jazz and pop. And so the piece So Wondrous, Sweet, and Fair will sound on the face of it very much the same in texture as something like Fair is the Heaven. But on the other hand, people will notice the use of, you might say, crunchier harmonies, the use of clever use of dissonance, and maybe even some jazz sonorities, and a very surprising final cadence when you know you're steeped in contemporary music. He is a native of Texas, a native of Fort Worth, Texas, and he has won multiple prizes, including the National Association for Music Education Composition Competition, and he is starting to get more attention. His full-time job is at Arkansas Tech University as the director of choral activities, but he is finding, I'm happy to say, finding a lot of time to compose. He's quite active, still a young man, born in 1985, and I'm hoping we will continue to get a lot more music from him in the future.
And we have Kevin Putz, who is known for opera and concertos.
He's certainly hit superstardom with his operas in a way that very few contemporary composers do. I mean, his latest opera, The Hours, which I have to say, if people have not seen it, go see it the next time you get a chance. It premiered in Philadelphia in 2022, and in the short time since then, the Metropolitan Opera has included it in two seasons because it was so successful the first time they showed it. And I loved it so much the first time I had to go back and see it again when they brought it back the next season. It's so moving. The music is just extraordinary. I mean, he certainly one of the greatest living opera composers, if not the greatest. He rose to stardom with his breakthrough opera was Silent Night, which is as moving for its music as for its storyline, about a true story about the truce, Christmas Eve truce in World War I, that will always be such a moving story. The idea that these soldiers engaged in deadly battle with each other would hear singing and that music would bring them together. They would lay down their arms and come together for a night as friends. And then, you know, the realities of the situation that they were. They, you know, went back to fighting each other. But just the idea that the Christmas holiday and singing could bring them together, of course, that's fodder for a great opera, and Kevin Putz took full advantage. The piece that we're going to be doing, it's called If I Were a Swan, and it's very challenging, partly because Kevin approaches the medium of choral music as though there's a clean slate, as though there are no restrictions on how you can use voices to create a piece of a cappella music. And I mean that completely as a compliment. I don't mean that he does not have the knowledge and has not heard other choral music, but it's so inventive. He has some of the parts doing these quick textures that do sound in a way like a more orchestral composer, but you hear this and you think, well, why haven't other choral composers done things like this? It's such a fresh take on choral music. So I'm eager for people to hear the piece. It is in 8 parts, wide ranges, quite demanding. It has one section that is a very intricate fugue among the 4 soprano and alto voices, just kind of creating a wash of sound, but very picturesque and I think unlike any choral piece people are likely to have heard.
Something, Rick Hoffenberg. The next piece and the next composer, if we know any composer, we might know Morten Larsen.
Absolutely, and this is a composer who's so well known that he has a movie about his life. That's when you know you've hit the big time. He's taught at the University of Southern California for over 40 years now, and many of his pieces have become staples of the choral canon. The one that we're doing, Shore in the Shining Night, is one of those pieces. This is a text by the great American writer James Agee that was set by Samuel Barber very famously. And sometimes when a particular text is set once and becomes really famous in that one setting, other composers stay away from it. But Morten Lauridsen, man, not only was he not intimidated by the fact that Barber had said it so beautifully, he wrote a setting that is equally successful, equally beautiful. It's different and yet so touching and haunting. Like all his music, it is very good in the voice. He writes with the knowledge of how things fit with singers and how they feel to sing, and it has these beautiful long phrases. It's really easy to listen to, and even if people have not heard it, it's the kind of piece that I think will seem familiar, even if it's the first time hearing it.
And that's a nice quality, isn't it? Yes.
For sure.
Tell us about Carrie Marsh.
Well, you know, Sarah Bareilles isn't necessarily a jazz singer, but Carrie Marsh took her song, more of a pop song, and infused some jazz into it. So we included it. It's more on the pop side of jazz, but we included it as a contrast in this set. It's beautifully set for a soloist and background, 6-part voices, and it's a very memorable tune and set so beautifully by Carrie Marsh, one of the I think, really most skilled vocal jazz arrangers of our time and most prolific. His music, it's a treasure trove to jazz choirs. Some of his arrangements are incredibly difficult. He is not afraid to push the boundaries. And Someone Who Loves Me certainly has its challenges, but it's been fun for the singers in the Marywood University Chamber Singers. I love vocal jazz. I just love it for its intrinsic value, but I also love including it because young singers coming out of high school often have a lot of experience with musical theater repertoire. They've been in their high school musicals, sometimes musicals in community theaters and so forth, but rarely do they have experience with vocal jazz. So I love introducing this as part of the curriculum, if you will, of the chamber singers so that they can get this experience of what is it like to do scat singing and what is it like to use jazz syllables and what about jazz style in terms of different approaches to how to use the voice. And it's I think, a wonderful and very beneficial challenge. So it's something that I love to do. We haven't done a full set of vocal jazz like this in a while, and I felt like it was time.
And so on to Pass Me the Jazz.
Yeah. So this is an original tune by Anders Edenroth, who's a member of the Swedish vocal quintet, The Real Group, a group that has been going strong for many years. They formed when they were still students, and they are incredible, absolutely incredible. And this was written for them. So talk about not afraid to challenge. It is extremely difficult, but once the members of our group, the chamber singers, once they're able to get over the hurdle of the initial, okay, we can do this, I love that they take pride in being able to conquer a challenge like this. So we're really having fun working it, trying to polish it, getting it up to tempo, working on the style. It's a wonderful, catchy tune, but very quick-moving, difficult, dissonant jazz harmonies, huge ranges. The bass line, it's a true walking bass line and could just as easily be taken by an actual string bass player and goes very, very low. You really have to have skilled singers, and I'm really lucky. I have really talented singers at Marywood, so makes it fun to do pieces like that.
And then a standard, right? It don't mean a thing.
Yeah, we finish with a song that I think many people will know, even though the young generation might not, because this is a song, it qualifies as an oldie. It's almost 100 years old. It don't mean a thing, originally written by Duke Ellington in 1931. But Anders Edenroth, the same arranger as composed Pass Me the Jazz, put his own stamp on It Don't Mean a Thing. And again, this was written for The Real Group, so quite challenging, but really a lot of fun. And we're enjoying the challenge.
Rick, where and when?
Sure. So in addition to our on-campus performance, which we do each semester, we're actually going to do a concert, the same program, at St. John the Evangelist in Pittston on Sunday, April 27th at 3 p.m., and then the following week at the Marian Chapel at the Swartz Center, which is on the Marywood campus, Sunday, May 4th at 2 o'clock. So two chances to hear it. And then we'll subsequently be taking it on tour to Florida. So I guess more than two chances, several more chances in Florida.
Maybe you like this cozy place I know just around the corner.
Sure,
sounds good. I prefer something special with a spouse.
Count me in, guys. I really gotta get a bike right away.
Wait up, I'll join you. I can feel.
Dr. Rick Hoffenberg, who is director of choral activities at Marywood University in Scranton, speaking about the upcoming concerts by the Marywood Chamber Singers, Sunday, April 27th at 3 in the afternoon, and that's St. John the Evangelist Church in Pittston, 3 o'clock, Sunday, April 27th. And then Sunday, May 4th at 2, it's a performance, the Marywood Chamber Singers with the same program in the Marian Chapel at Marywood in Scranton. For more information on the web, marywood.edu, marywood.edu. In addition, the Marywood Concert Choir and the Northeastern Pennsylvania Philharmonic will partner to present Carl Orff's scenic cantata Carmina Burana on Friday, April 25th at the F.M. Kirby Center in downtown Wilkes-Barre at 7:30 p.m. For more information, nepaphil.org, N-E-P-A-P-H-I-L.org.